Hi Ben.
Hi, Chris.
How are you?
I'm very well, my friend. How are you?
Yeah, really, really good. Glad it's Friday. Been a busy, busy week, but this is a great way to round off the week, to be honest. So I'm glad you and I are having a catch up. So
Yeah, thanks for having me. No, appreciate that. Appreciate that. It has been a crazy, year, then about a week, but yeah.
I know. Every time we talk to each other, it's I know you've got so much going on in your world. It kind of likewise in mine, and it feels like we always talk to each other at the end of a week as well, and we kind of download everything that's been going on recently, and it's
Yeah.
always a pretty
And we're
noisy.
disheveled and we're exhausted and we're a shell of the men we were at the start of the week.
Absolutely.
Maybe we should record this on a Monday.
It's not bad, to be honest. But look, back to the formalities. Ben, welcome to the Employer Bland podcast. Real pleasure to have you on.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So look, just for anybody that doesn't know, and I'm very confident that stacks of people will already know who you are, but look, Ben Phillips, EVP, Employer Brand, Talent Marketing Specialist, also previous Employer Brand Talent Marketing Lead at companies like IBM, Hootsuite, Tesco, to name a couple. Also an incredibly active contributor to our community, to the employer brand talent marketing community. And I must say, tip of the hat and a thank you, sir, for the content that you've been putting out there. Not
Oh,
just in the last,
thank you.
it's only been in the last 12 months that I've been digesting the content in its droves. I know you've been doing it. I know you've been doing it
That your subtler way of saying, for God's sake, man, shut up?
Not at all, and I'd tell you that if I thought
I
it.
know you would. And I'm sure some people out there think that, but hey, it is what it is.
But yeah, I must say, as you already know, massively enjoying your content, and I know lots of people will already be following you on LinkedIn and the other platforms. But if you're not, do give Ben a follow, because very active contributor and some really, really cool stuff out there. But Ben, just to kick things off, before we go into the main conversation,
Sure.
I just really wondered if you could give everybody a bit of an insight to the man that Ben Phillips is, but going back as well to kind of where things started, maybe where you grew up, early influences, life, business, wherever you really want to take this. But
Wow.
it's kind of just trying to push away the veneer shop window of LinkedIn a little bit for a moment to I suppose get under the bonnet of who this man is in front of me right now.
Yeah. Well, I should have got my chaise lounge. I'm about to go into therapy, ladies and gentlemen. Sit tight and grab the tissues. Here we go. So I grew up in the northwest corner of the M25, which is a big motorway that circles Greater London. I grew up in a place called Edgware. And normal upbringing, I guess. Same as everyone else. Grew up with parents who an interesting combination, and parents always are, who ended up getting divorced. But I had a dad who was quite quick-witted. It was an interesting combination, actually. And the reason why I'm mentioning that is because I think about work and my work ethic. I think that came from my dad, because although I came from a middle-class background, my dad had very working-class jobs. He was a minicab driver or a market trader. And from the age of 10 or 11, he used to take me down to the market. So he said, "Right, son, you want your pocket money? Come and graft for it."
Love that. Love that.
And I did, freezing cold winters. I remember, which was funny, later on in life, I was going out with a young lady in my teens, and she was quite well to do, quite a posh background. I remember being at a party, and one of the boys that she knew from her private school said, "Oh, what does your dad do?" And I said, "Oh, he worked." Well, he said, "What does your father do?" And I said, "Oh, he works on the markets." And he went, "Oh, what commodities, oil and gas?" I went, "No, Wembley." As he scurried off, like, "I'm not dealing with this hooligan." And yeah, so I'm not a religious person at all, and we're not going to go there. He's not going to get that deep. But I'm an atheist now. But it's important to understand that I grew up in a Jewish community, so a Jewish upbringing, not a religious one. So I went to a state school with a father who was like that, working on the market. So a good that my street wiseness came from there, and my humour comes from there, because you had to have thick skin growing up in northwest London as a Jewish kid. with, you know, and it was challenging, right? The racism and all that kind of stuff, and then being on markets and having to tough it out in cold winter days. So I think that's a lot of my humor and my disability to laugh at stuff comes from there. My mum, on the other hand, was, let's say, a bit more refined, or is, let's say, a bit more refined, a bit more sophisticated. A bit like Miss Bouquet, if you remember Miss Bouquet, the character.
I do. Great character.
Yeah, and that combination, I think, is throughout my life and my career. Hard work, but with a sense of humour, not taking myself too seriously. So anyway, went to state school. I always been interested in people, and to a point where I studied psychology as an A-level. And then I did business. I actually wanted to be an actor, believe it or not. But my mum, going through a terrible divorce, couldn't afford to have an out of work actor on her books. She said, "You're not being an actor. Go and do business studies." So I did business studies. So business and marketing and communication and psychology and how people work. I think it's interesting. I look back and you look at the stuff I'm doing now, and it's all there, right? It's still all there. So at university, I studied marketing as a major. Didn't know I had to choose a minor until I turned up on day one, and they said, "You need a minor," and I didn't know what the hell to do, so I just said to my friend, "What are you doing?" He said, "Information business systems," and I went, "Hell, that'll do." Chose that.
Yeah.
The driest subject in the world. Why I did it, I don't know, but there you go, the choice you make. And studied marketing, came out of university not knowing what I wanted to do. Marketing would have probably been a good career choice, considering the education path I took, and I fell into recruitment. I had bills to pay, debts to pay off. Fell into recruitment for a couple. The plan was to do it for a couple of years. I heard the money was decent, and 8 years later, I was still in it, probably hating the last 2 years of it, to be honest.
Yeah, and this is traditional kind of agency recruitment.
Agency recruitment. Hammer the phones. Smile when you dial. The power hour.
Yeah,
all that crap.
Yeah. On your feet, don't sit down until you've got a new requirement type of recruitment.
Yeah, using the term consultant very loosely.
Yeah.
But actually, I didn't, and that's probably why I wasn't the best consultant. I wasn't the worst consultant recruiter, but I wasn't the best because I didn't have that make money at all costs thing in me.
Mm-hmm.
I was, you know, you get stupid targets like make 100 candidate calls a week, or you've got to set up 10 client meetings a week and all that crap.
Yeah.
But I wanted to consult the candidates. I'd be too honest. I would say, "I don't think this role's right for you," or I'd help them with their CV and their career, their interview preparation, but take time. And I think that's also a thread that's run through me. That love of learning, helping others develop and grow. Mm-hmm. So in that 8 years of recruitment, I actually took 6 months out and turned my hand to teaching.
All right.
So I was a high school teacher for 2 terms. It was a car crash of a career choice. Maybe another story for another time over a beer.
Yeah.
I did it for 6 months. Because I've always had this bee in my bonnet about wanting to educate, help others grow, develop.
Yeah.
And then I came running back into commerce and industry, begging them to take me back because I couldn't stand the politics and the teachers. The kids were fine. It was the politics and the teachers that drove me mad.
Yeah. I thought you were going to say the opposite. Yeah. But it was.
No. I was 26, 27 at the time. So I was quite, you know, I wasn't. But to the kids, I was the young, cool teacher, you know.
Yeah.
In a state school in North London, where kids would turn up into lessons drunk because they'd been in the park or stoned or whatever they were doing. And I'd just, anyway, I shouldn't say that, but you know, you turned a blind eye because I was the cool teacher. Anyway, 2 terms in, I thought, sod this for a game of soldiers. I'm out. I'm tapping out.
Yeah.
But the education piece is another thread, the strand that pulls through. So anyway, I did recruitment, went in-house to Pizza Hut, mm-hmm. UK, the Yum Group, to head up their head office recruitment. And that passion for learning and education was still very strong, and I was very fortunate in Pizza Hut. Great company to work for, fantastic culture, one of the best, even to this day, one of the best recognition cultures I've ever worked in. It was brilliant. And I managed to diversify, so I started a recruitment, and then I got into learning and development formally there.
So that passion for learning and development, you know, because obviously there was that brief stint in teaching. Then you fall into L&D, you know, during the Pizza Hut phase. Is that always, has there always been something inside you for the, you know, people to develop and that education piece.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
100%. So anyway, so at Pizza Hut, so we're talking, what, 2009, 2010? I joined there in 2007, just before the financial crisis. And then Facebook started coming to the fore. So I actually, back then, was started to blog about social technology in recruitment, as it was then. And I I created a blog called Treknology, right, which those who have known me in recruitment for all this time will probably remember it and laugh. And, but it was me trying to be clever. It was a mixture. It was an amalgamation of training, recruitment, education, and knowledge. Treknology.
Oh, wow. So you haven't amalgamated two words. You've thought...
Yeah, I went, yeah. Let's go the whole hog, because SEO loves that shit. Let's do that. let's use a word that doesn't make sense, that no one will search for, because that will obviously make me really visible on Google. Anyway, you live and learn.
Hindsight.
There's always been that bit in me, and maybe this comes from, as I said, the background of that rawness of working on markets and that sense of humor and being able to laugh, of just holding up the mirror, right? And that's what I would do. I was trying to be helpful, but also poking at the recruitment industry for all its foibles and, you know, poking hornet's nest. I don't necessarily like confrontation, but I'm not afraid to call it out. And that's how I like people to deal with me, very candid, shoot from the hip, tell me how it is, we, you know, respectfully. But yeah, that's also a part of me.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I was blogging about this and I was speaking at events at the time. And then someone from Tesco said, you know, this stuff you're talking about, social media and recruitment, would you like to come and do it for us? I was like, hell yes, please. And that's when Tesco for 5 years, started off as social media and employer brand recruitment manager. And then the world at Tesco went crazy, and that then loads, you know, it was mad, Tesco, in that period. Philip Clark had left, Dave Lewis came in, huge culture transformation. And I managed to continue the L&D thread. So I did that for a bit, helped them with their career website on the PLC, on the .com site.
Yeah.
Got their main career website project out the ground, chose the back end provider, which at the time was Tripad, when Lisa Scales was there. We're going back a long time. Mm. And then the world went mad, and I ended up going back into learning and development, culture transformation, leadership development. And then at that time, people were also talking about, you know, recruiters should think like marketers. So I took that literally and managed to, you know, get a role in marketing, where I stayed for 3 years, ended up at F&F, their clothing range, looking after the social media team. And then I think following 6 rounds of redundancies at Tesco head office, I think the 7th month came along and I volunteered for it. I said, time to change. And then I left and got into digital projects, then went to Hootsuite, social media, and then ended up at Radency, back into Radency. So tying up all those threads, Radency was a great opportunity for me to take my digital people, communication, L&D, join them as a strategist and tie it into a nice little package.
I can imagine, actually, how that worked really nicely.
Yeah, as a strategist, put all that stuff together and being able to educate clients and support them and advise them through all those things. And digital social communication, it's agnostic, whether the audience is a consumer or customer or colleagues.
Yeah.
It's communication. And then things got a bit bumpy. So Hootsuite redundancy, got called thinking the day I was about to be promoted into a new team I was going for. And got a call from Canada saying, we're so sorry, we've got to let you go. That was before Radency, then went to Radency. After Radency, I left Radency, went into IBM. IBM was redundancy. And then I left IBM and went into Happening, my last company, and again, redundancy. So here I am. So all that content you see is because I've got time on my hands.
Yeah. Although, and again, I won't steal your thunder. I know you've got a lot of announcements to come, but I know there's some very good things to be talking about on that front from you in the couple of weeks and months. So everyone can look forward to some of that. It's,
stay tuned, everyone.
Yeah. Absolutely. But some really, really, thank you so much, by the way, for that synopsis, Ben. And I didn't know tons of that stuff. And it's really, really nice to get under the bonnet of kind of your journey and where you've come from. One of the really interesting things is I worked on Leighton Buzzard Market for 11 years. Just, and I got my first job when I was 20 years old. I was supposed to go to university, didn't, but I worked on Leighton Buzzard. It's the pet food stall. My mum worked on the fruit and veg stall, and she got me.
Brilliant.
And my mum got me my job on the thing. So you talking about your dad and also some of the stigma around conversations you'd have with people. I've been through all that as well. So we should try and see if there's this huge correlation with employer branders
and marketing tool traders.
We might be the biggest discovery ever known in our field. Who knows?
Well, and these things give you that hardiness, right? That toughness, that resilience, that grit. So my dad, over his many years as a market trader, he went from selling crockery to sportswear to ladies' fashion. And when you're a 12-year-old boy in a market stall in a freezing cold December day, and you've got women coming in asking about dress sizes and yeah, bundling them into the back of the van so they can try it on behind some makeshift dress changing room.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, yeah, you soon learn to grow. As I say, street smarts, yeah. And thankfully, I had my mum for the book smarts as well.
Yeah, absolutely. But you know, I think there are so many, you know, crossover skills, and at such a young age, having to engage with so many different people from so many different walks of life. It's, I don't know, I certainly got into my late teens and early 20s feeling like I could tackle most social situations, you know, because of that grounded. It's probably similar.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So look, let's get into the main topic. So one of the things I wanted to touch on with you was based on a post that you put out. It must have been, you know, a few months ago. And something more recently, I've kind of, you know, told you how interested I was kind of reading this. And it would be really fun at some point to kind of get under the bonnet of it. And hence the reason we're having this conversation now. But it was a post that you put out there, and it was all around the psychological principles of employer branding. And I think many of the principles were based on some learnings that you'd taken from books, you know, via kind of Rory Sutherland and some other areas. But what was really cool from my perspective is how you'd taken a lot of these principles of, you know, core branding and corporate branding, and you'd managed to kind of, you know, bring it over to our world, and also apply a lot of those principles to just things like the people experience process, for example, and how those core principles kind of, you know, affect the things that we all work on day to day. But yeah, look, just diving into the psychological principles of employer branding, could you give us all a bit of an overview to what some of these principles are?
Yeah, sure. I'll try my best and try and keep it as succinct as possible. So it's good to have there's a bit of background to the thinking around this as well. So other things, that trends that I'm seeing in our profession at the moment is budgets are being cut, headcounts are being reduced, people have got shed loads that needs to be done. Where do you start? How do you prioritize? What do you pick? How do you pick what to do? So there's that. I've also been fortunate in my time at IBM to, you know, dive a little bit deep. I'm by no means an expert, but probably know enough to be dangerous, actually. But, you know, around design thinking,
yeah,
and agile methodology, and essentially it's, and even in my time at Tesco, I was heavily involved in innovation, their innovation agenda. As this whole thing around put the customer at the heart of everything you do. We've been banging on about this for years. The whole digital transformation. What do people mean when they talk about digital transformation, as they have been doing for the last 12, 15 years? Digital transformation is put the customer at the heart. And I think if I remember correctly, this was driven by Amazon, Jeff Bezos, because he hasn't done too badly off the back of doing that. So you've got that. So you've got limited resources, reducing budgets. Where do I start? What do I do? How do I blah, blah, blah? And then you've got marry that with design thinking or digital transformation principle of putting the customer at the heart. And then I came across this. I think I first heard it on Steve Bartlett, Diary of a CEO, which I used to love, but then it just became an advert for Zoe and Huel, and I got sick and tired of it. But he had a great podcast with Rory Sutherland. And then I read Rory's book, Alchemy, which just blew my mind. Brilliant book. But it's all about the psychology of marketing in this data-obsessed world that we currently live in. And I lean more towards the creative side of things than the data. Even though people perceive me to be quite data driven, I'm not. I'm more creative in my head, at least. So you take all those things, and I was here listening to him talk, and I just, as I was in my kind of morning dog walk when I listened to these things, and as he was speaking, I thought, I was in a role that was happening, and we had that challenge. What do we do? I've got no resources. How do you prioritize all this? There's so much you can do. And he started talking about habituation, number one, which I covered in a separate post because my articles are becoming too long. But habituation is that thing where, as humans, we become desensitized to things very quickly, whether it's smells or sounds. You know, you put a room fragrance in your room, and after a few weeks, you'll stop smelling it. But people come in, and so you dial it up. The missus will dial it up. And people, your guests walk in and start choking. It's like, oh my God, it's like I've been hit in the face with pepper spray. And you're sitting there going, what? I can't smell anything, because you've become habituated to it.
Yeah.
An element of habituation is something called semantic satiation. Semantic words, satiation, I am full. But it's where people use these words and you become immune to it. And he talks about, you know, the word revolution. It's a revolution. It used to be used in the old days where it was real revolutions, communities, societies revolting against their leadership and their political powers. But now everything was a revolution. And we have it in our words, right? You hear the word innovation, collaboration, empathy. Everyone's using it in their EVPs. But we don't even register it anymore. It's like you roll your eyes subconsciously and it's just, it evaporates. So there's that. So that's what's driving me to push for. We've got to, how do we stand out? People want to be distinctive. Can they be distinctive in their EVPs? My first EVP was Tesco 12 years ago. And guess what the pillars were? Collaboration, empathy, resilience, responsiveness, innovation.
Mm.
Fast forward 10 years, they're all the bloody same. Just call them something different. It's a variation. It's either those or a variation of those.
And most other companies are a variation of those, or very, very
correct. Correct. Yeah. You look at any EVP and you can line them all up, and they're all saying, they might be saying it slightly differently, but they all mean the same thing. Anyway, so is there distinctiveness? Can you be distinctive in your EVP? Some might be able to, some generally might be able to. But if you can't be distinctive in your EVP, then be distinctive in how you articulate your EVP. And that's where, if you know about habituation and this semantic satiation, makes me sound very clever, but it's not me. You've stolen this blatantly all of Rory Sutherland. But that was my first, actually, there's something in there. And then he started talking about the peak end rule. And I don't know, just because of my experiences, right? It's that tacit experience, not that explicit, it's that tacit. All these things that I've been doing over the years have started to come together in this article or his book. And we've been doing it anyway, but for me, it's just nice to be able to put something, a label on it, and call it something. That's what it is. That helps me articulate it now. So the peak end rule, what's the peak end rule? It's where we overemphasize our recollection of an experience based on the peak part and the end part of it. The peak part being the most intensive part of it. I.e., and the example I use in my video was, you go on a day trip with the family, and it's quite a drab, dreary day. Nothing really eventful happens, even though with best intentions, but it was just one of those days. I'm not sure if you got a family, Chris? You got?
Yes. Yeah. You got a wife and four children.
Four kids. That's it. I thought I knew. So, yeah, you go one of these days out and it's just drab. But on the way home, the beautiful view, and you stop, you get out the car, you think, let's get out of the car for 10 minutes, just take a break. And you get out and you look at the view. And then on the way home, there's no traffic. Easy to get home in, you know, you save half an hour of the journey. No one's argued. You haven't wanted to murder the kids. You get home anyway. The day is done. And as I said, 95% of that day was drab and dreary. But when you look back, you remember the view, which was the peak part of it, and you remember the end of it being the journey home, which was lovely. And you go, that's actually a really nice day. Mm-hmm. Let's do it again. So that's the peak end rule. And I go, hang on. Candidate experience. This is where design thinking comes in, and user journeys and so on and so forth. Look at the user journey for a candidate who never engages you. So before they hit your website, what happens? They hit a bit of social content. They then hit the website. Do they look for, when well, they get either engaged with content or they look for a job? 9 times out of 10, the role ends with a job.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they find that job, they'll read it and they apply. And then they end up in the ATS, underbelly of the ATS usually, which screws most people's user journeys. Another story for another time.
Yeah.
And so on and so forth, right? And it continues. So they apply for a job. And then at that slice of that part of that candidate experience, they're then waiting. Have I got the job or haven't I got? Or am I going to be shortlisted or aren't I going to be shortlisted?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the peak part of that process is the application bit.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the social media. It's not coming to the career site. It's not looking at content. It's not looking at jobs. It's the bit where you start applying and finish the application. That's the peak bit. And then the end bit is the decision of whether you've been progressed or not. So if you, this is just a basic example, there's more elements you can put in, you know, more steps in that process, and the career website in itself could be its own industry of a project, which I have been involved in as well. But taking that example, going back to what I said earlier, what do I do? What do we improve? Where do I prioritize? If that's your chain sequence of events at that part of the user journey, focus on the peak and the end. So you would hone in and go, right, what's the application process like? Because ultimately, that's what candidates come to the site for, right?
Of course. Yeah, of course. And so using that example, Ben, so the peak end, you know, of your, the, you know, the first example that you gave, the family are out, this is amazing view, they take in this view for 15 minutes, super memorable. It's like all this other crap's gone on that day, but that's the thing that's really stuck with them. That's what they take home. The journey home's good. So they, you know, they've had this amazing experience. So applying that to the people experience journey that you've just articulated.
Yes.
So when you look at things like, maybe just before they apply for the job, there might be content, for example,
yes,
that they're exposed to that resonates, that is kind of, you know, it's relevant to them and it's kind of engaging and all that type of stuff. Could that also be a peak end moment, or would you always apply it to the application part of the process because it is just naturally the peak of that sequence of events?
Totally depends on your individual user journeys and how you decide you want to slice it up. So
yeah.
When I was going to run this project happening before, let's just say the brown stuff hit the air mover,
yeah,
putting it politely, I'd broken it up into three sections. So we were going to look at the application and apply stage.
Yeah.
So the application, before you hit site, where you've engaged with it, might be at an event, face-to-face, it might be social. I just use social as a loose example.
Yeah.
And then the end of that section of that experience was, you've applied, you're waiting, do you get accepted or rejected?
Mm.
And if you're accepted, then I got into the interview and hire stage, which was then broken down into, right, you've got the decision, you're progressing, then you're waiting for an interview.
Mm-hmm.
Then you've got multiple interview stages. And after each interview stage, you've got that wait. Mm-hmm. And then it's again, is it a go, no-go decision?
Yeah.
And then you had the onboarding phase, and that's where we were going to stop this project. So it depends how you want to slice up your user journey.
Yeah, fine.
But if you think about it, that for me, again, with my recruitment background and all the other the candidate experience and customer experience, if you think about it, and I've been going through this quite a bit, actually, I see content on a site or on social or whatever. I've applied for jobs. The bit I remember the most, number one, the application process. That might be because I'm very familiar with ATSs and I know the challenges of them because I've lived this world. I'm very, you know, it's very close to me.
Mm-hmm.
That's the bit I remember. I don't remember the social post that brought me there. It might have been good. Who knows? Who cares?
Yeah.
That's a different story, right? You need loads of that. But the thing I remember was your application. Was it quick, seamless? You asked me only for the information that you needed in that value proposition transaction at that part of the journey. You need my name, you need my details, you need my CV. Have I uploaded my CV? But now your system is so old and clunky that it now asks me to fill out everything that's on my CV and those stupid bloody things that pop, you know, that crap, right? But I can't believe it still happens in this world with all the technology we've got.
Or is it Workday and you have to create a brand new file just to...
Let's not make this about an ATS slanging match because we haven't got long enough. But so for me, that's the peak.
Mm.
And then you're waiting by the phone.
Yeah.
Am I accepted? And this feeling is, you know, if you really want the job, am I going to progress? Am I going to progress? Is that, and so this is a nice segue into the other side of the principles, right?
And you refer to this piece as idleness, which I really like.
Well, so it's the behavioral principle, and all these came out of Uber Labs. Uber did loads of research. They had behavioral psychologists. They had all these proper scientists. That's where this came from.
Yeah.
They had Uber Labs, which looked at their users of the Uber app, and they had idleness aversion. In terms of how do you optimize the candidate's experience, you have to consider things like idleness aversion, operational transparency, uncertainty anxiety. Three mm-hmm. core behavioral principles that if you are familiar with and you can apply them on user journey, will give at least the impression that you're giving a great experience. So idleness aversion. Humans naturally do not like hanging around doing nothing. Mm-hmm. And you may be able to relate to this. I feel this in my bones. If the choice is to sit in a traffic jam doing nothing for 10 minutes versus taking a detour where I can keep moving, but it's going to take me 20 minutes, I would rather do the latter.
Yeah, I'd rather double the journey.
Correct. Versus sat there idle, the thought I'm actually doing something and I'm having an impact on, and I mean, not control, but you know what I mean? I'd rather do, and it's the same thing. So you apply that to the candidate experience. Mm-hmm. I have applied for a job. I'm now sat there idle. You mix with idleness aversion, operational transparency. I have thrown my CV into an ATS. What's happening? Has that just gone into a database graveyard amongst another 1,000 applications where whether I'm seen or not is just pure luck? Mm. It's not even a human looking at it now. Is it AI? And the example that Rory Sutherland uses is if you're at a train station and there's an announcement that your train is going to be late, there's a lot more transparency, and it removes, and this actually is about the next one as well, uncertainty, anxiety. They're all mixed together. Would you rather know your train is going to be late, full stop, mm-hmm. or would you rather know would you rather know your train is going to be late, full stop, or would you rather know your train is going to be late by 2 hours?
Late by 2 hours, if it's accurate. Correct. Yeah.
It's transparent. It reduces the anxiety. You know where you stand. And the example they use in commerce, consumer marketing and consumer experiences is Domino's. Domino's pizza, they were getting loads of complaints, people ringing the stores because their pizzas weren't turning up. Mm-hmm. Where's my pizza? Where's my pizza? And then that became a vicious cycle because the people who were meant to be cooking the pizzas were picking up the phones, dealing with angry customers. Ergo, further delays, more angry customers. So to counter this, what Domino's did was they started giving promotions. You may remember this. If your pizza is late by 30 minutes, you get it for free.
I think I do, actually, yeah.
Yeah, I'm old enough to remember that promotion. I think they might even still do it. I don't know. It had no impact on the volume of calls coming through. So then they released the pizza tracker, which, as you know, you can go log in and you can see where your pizza is in the process. Is it in preparation, in the oven, etc.? And what they realized was that the complaints went through the floor, but the profits went through the roof, because even though they were offering free pizzas for ones that were over 30 minutes, people didn't want free pizza. They just wanted to know where their pizzas were. So that operational transparency removed the idleness aversion, because you had the little dial that shows you where your pizza is, which is a bit engaging. Mm-hmm. And it removes the anxiety. Am I going to have to order another dinner? I've got guests here. Well, they're getting hungry. So it was just genius. So you put all that together and you map that now on the candidate experience. So going back to the example we used before, taking my example, the application part is the peak. You're told whether you've been accepted or not is the end of that particular section of that journey, part of the journey. Then you're left hanging around. Am I going to be progressed? What's happening? So you think, how can you improve that part of the process, knowing that people are going through that idleness aversion? How do you help them avoid standing still and thinking like they're doing nothing? How do you give them the operational transparency? And how do you remove as much anxiety as possible from the process? Mm-hmm. Bearing in mind what I mentioned at the very start around people don't have resources, they don't have the headcount, they don't have the budget. Where do you prioritize? So in this example, when I was about to run this workshop in my last company, one of the recommendations was going to be, A, we've got to fix the application process, potentially, because that's the peak. How do you handle it when people are waiting for their response? So when you give your communication, make sure that you give them something to do. Here's a video, here's some hints and tips, et cetera, et cetera. Or in your communication that comes out the ATS, don't just say, thanks for your application, we'll be in touch. Because that's the train saying, we're very sorry, your train's late. Well, how late? When are you going to be in touch? And a great example I've had, which I've been sharing recently, is a company I applied for who said, we will be in touch ideally in 2 weeks, worst case 4 to 5 weeks.
Yeah, do you know what? I was just going to pick up on that, actually, because there are so many organizations, especially, you know, probably in many cases, the slightly larger organizations that are under-resourced, they've got high volumes of applications where, you know, their time to hire is really high and their, you know, the time it takes them to feedback to candidates is extremely long, just like you've kind of highlighted there. Could be 2 weeks, might be 5 weeks, whatever. But again, going back to your kind of earlier point of if the train's late, wouldn't you like to know it's going to be 2 hours late? Sometimes you just got to wear those scars, haven't you? And if you know that you've got a bad process or a slightly elongated or longer process than you should, just communicate some of that stuff.
It's interesting, right? So high volume recruitment hasn't really been my thing. Even when I was in hospitality and retail, my main focus was kind of white collar, mid management and upwards. I've done some high volume early career work in agency side, so I get it, right? When it's high volume, it's, you can't give the white glove treatment. There's just too many people in too many candidates to deal with. But this particular company who I shared content about in my recent experience, they turned around and said, every application we get is looked at by human. Mm-hmm. Hence the reason it takes us some time. Mm-hmm. Now, we'd love to give you really detailed feedback. Sometimes that may not be possible. Now, again, you could argue, oh, that's a bit of a shit experience. But they're doing the best they can do with what they've got. They're being transparent.
Yeah.
By saying we'll be in touch within 2 weeks, ideally, worst case 4 to 5 weeks, you could argue it's a bit of a crap timing. Oh, come on, you know, I'm Mr. Entitled over here. I demand to be seen tomorow. Some people are like
owning it, aren't they? They're owning it.
Yeah, they're right. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, and they covered everything. And in this particular great case example, they said, here are three links in the email. Go learn about a company, something else about helping you. I can't remember what it was, interview prep or something or other, and something else. Mm-hmm. So that's, again, I don't know whether they're doing it by design or it was just luck or they're just nice people who get people, but that helped with the arduousness aversion. It gave me something to do to fill the time.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I must say, it fascinates me, and I think it's so relatable. Those principles are so incredibly relatable to the people experience process, and I can see why you kind of touched upon it, you know, when you first did that piece of content, but there's still so many layers. Like you and I think could talk for another hour just around idleness aversion.
Yeah.
And okay, just, you know, distill all of that into idleness aversion and what really cool principles of what idleness aversion tactics can you apply to different parts of the people experience process. Mm. And again, just looking at one element, Ben, like you could really go in, couldn't you? There's so many different things. And you could probably be really creative with it as well, because I'd imagine you don't want to give people that are waiting for news, they don't want loads of tasks to necessarily do. They've got more important things, you know, to take care of. But there are still so many things, like you were saying, whether it's update videos, little snippets of communication or whatever it might be.
No, I was going to say, and as I said, this came out of Uber Labs, which was their behavioral science department, and how can you really maximize the user experience. Idleness aversion. When having that golden nugget of insight and operational transparency shaped their whole user experience within their app. Mm. So the thing with hailing a cab, how much is it going to cost me? I don't know if you know the good old days in the 90s or the early noughties, you order a minicab. I don't know if this is going to be a charlatan who's just going to decide, hey, heck, I'm going to slap £20 on the bill because this guy is slightly drunk on a Friday night. And hey, you know what? So operational transparency. Uber, what do they do? They gave you the fee up front. Do you accept? Artemis aversion, where's my cab? Don't know where my cab is. How long am I going to be sitting here? They created the map. Not only did they create the map, but they put the little car on it. So you can physically watch the car coming towards you. Take those principles, apply it to recruitment, marketing, candidate experience. And the final one, which is worth talking about, which is very important. And I've known about this for a long time. I'm a keen road cyclist. So I've known about David Brailsford. He took British Cycling. The term marginal gains is what he used in part to take British Cycling out of the cauldrons that it was in kind of early, you know, 2000s, to the point where bike manufacturers wouldn't even sponsor the British Cycling team because they would, it would have been a taint on their reputation to winning gold at the Beijing Olympics in 2008. And it was due to marginal gains, which essentially is he dissected everything that goes into riding a bike successfully, like everything. And he looked to make 1% improvements on all those collective things.
Wow.
And he took it, he stripped it right back. So he took the cyclists, he changed their post-exercise, their diets, obvious things, their diets, their hydration, their massage rubs. Mm-hmm. He made them take mattresses on tour with them. So they all had the same mattress. They all had the same pillows that they were used to improve their sleep. Mm-hmm. The trucks with the bikes in them, he painted the walls white so you could see the dust, so the dust wouldn't get into the mechanics of the machines and the bikes, just to improve machinery. He took every, he literally dissected the whole process of riding a bike to win a championship and said, let's just improve it all by 1%, each bit 1%, tiny, tiny. That on their own, you go 1%, that's nothing. As a collective, all those 1% became British Cycling all the way through to us winning the first Tour de France with Bradley. So you look at this, go, oh my god, there's so much to do. It's like, yes, there is, but 1%. Look at your email comms coming at your ATS. That's not a big arduous task. That's half a day of someone looking at your comms. Depends how much comms you've got come going out. It might be a few days' work. Just improve the comms.
Absolutely.
If it currently says thanks for your application, marginal gain. Thank you very much for your application. We get a load of these. We will try our best to get back to you within next weeks. We may be slightly longer. It's a marginal gain.
Absolutely. Yeah. And what are your thoughts, Ben, as well? Like when we look at trying to create content at scale, you know, storytelling at scale, that type of stuff, because we all know it's, you know, I don't think anybody is completely cracked that, but we know that content storytelling is great for employer branding, you know, as when it's as real and as authentic as possible, and it's situated in the right places, distributed in the right places, put out to the right audiences, it's gold dust. But it can be very difficult to strategically kind of get those processes in place. So you are, you know, getting out to the right people inside your business, you're galvanizing those groups where they're motivated to create content, get it back to you, however that two-way process is working. So that's content creation, that's storytelling, that's us getting all that great fuel for our content strategies. That's one kind of strand. But if we look at like operational efficiencies, let's call it, you know, some of these elements that we're talking about through the people experience process, is there an argument to say, or have you ever done this? Have you heard of people doing it where you can take some of these elements and you can actually test it, you know, inside your business with like, you know, workshop groups. So whether that's, you know, I don't know, you know, whether that's parts of the application process, instead of, you know, going out externally to 1,000 people, are there groups internally where you could work with them on particular strands of the people experience strategy to test, learn, iterate, da da da, before you actually launch externally?
If I understand the question correctly, I'll give you an example of what we were about to do. And I had pulled together the heads of reward, the heads of L&D, the heads of communication, the HRVP, the heads of talent acquisition, and I was about to run this workshop, which had mapped out this part of the candidate experience. And we were going to, with it in their teams, we were going to go through, literally imagine a big wall with post-its on it, and you had the experience mapped out. And we were going to apply these principles. So you get to, let's take the onboarding bit, right? What happens on onboarding? So I've accepted a role, and now I'm in idleness aversion again, because from the point of acceptance, I could be on a 3-month period before I start.
Yeah.
So how you, and now I've got anxiety, it's my God, it's my first day at my new school, and all, you know, we're all human. We close your eyes for a split second, put yourself in that situation, and you'll feel the anxiety bubble up. We've all been there, right? The excitement, new opportunity, but there's that anxiety as well. So I don't know if this answers your question, but the plan was for then the head of L&D, who looked after that onboarding part of the process, to work with her L&D guys and girls, who know the internal audience, and say, well, what can we do?
Yeah.
How often do we communicate? Well, currently, they get one email. Okay, so what can the hiring manager do? Well, the hiring manager could call them once a week with an update. What part of their documentation could we do? I know there's things with security and so on and so forth. You can't give so much until someone's got their formal email address, but what can you give them?
Yeah.
I don't know if that answers your question.
No, it absolutely does. And I think it stems back to kind of how can employer branders and the small teams that you often see in businesses try and lighten the load through sharing the load within the larger organization. So for example, you know, exactly as you've just kind of illustrated there, Ben, you know, there are certain moments of idleness where if there was, you know, the communication you were talking about, you know, potentially, you know, putting out to the external market, you know, in those periods of idleness for candidates. So I'm sitting idle for 2 weeks. I've had no feedback. Trying to kind of leverage internal resources, whether it's hiring managers, the hiring community, people in specific teams or whatever, to contribute ideas, contribute content, contribute, I suppose, different methods of communication during those periods of idleness. So you don't have to always have it. I just get this sense that employer branders, you know, particularly in smaller teams, have such a huge weight of responsibility around they always need to have the answers.
And well,
always needs and to know, be. Yeah, go on.
You know what that is born from, I think, is that some employer branders think they own the employer brand.
Yes.
And I always say that I'm not the owner of the employer brand. I am the custodian of the employer brand.
I love that.
Yeah. We all own the employer brand. It goes back to a point I think I've heard you talk about on your podcast before. Whether engineered or not, you have an employer brand. You're just you either manage it or it's just there based on how you behave and how candidates and employees perceive you based on the experiences they have with you. So as the custodian of the employer brand and partly then the culture, because I firmly believe that culture sits at the heart of all of this. You may have seen my previous content on culture, wrapped with an EVP, wrapped with the brand, distributed through your talent marketing.
Yeah.
If you're the custodian, then it's just a segue into a conversation with other stakeholders.
Yeah.
So I am the custodian. So as we just talked about, the employer brand isn't pretty pictures on social media and a website, which unfortunately a lot of people think it is.
Yeah.
HR directors, talent acquisition leaders, and you only have to look at the jobs being advertised. And I've seen so many of this. People aren't looking for EB managers. What they are looking for is social media and content managers who can come into their team and do a bit of EB stuff, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. I've seen loads of it. I even wrote a post bemoaning it because they're asking for too much for one person.
Yeah, I remember it.
So if you're the custodian, like I did, as the custodian, if we're going to talk about the brand upstream, and we're going to do the social posts that hopefully, not always, but hopefully are representative and reveal the realities of what it's like to work here. And those realities are underpinned by what our culture is really like. And our culture is supported by our values. And those values are driven by our behaviors. Then I can brand that. But if I then come to a website and the experience is counter to that, you start to damage the brand.
Yeah.
If I apply, I don't hear from you for 3 weeks. You've damaged the brand. If I hear from you, but I don't get an interview for 4 weeks, you've damaged the brand. If I have an interview and I get the job and I don't, and I start, but no one contacts me in my period, I damage the brand. If I have an onboarding experience and I'm just left with it, I turn up on day one, I don't have a laptop, I don't have a mobile phone, my team doesn't even know I'm turning up on that day, you've damaged the brand. Now, I'm the custodian. I'm not responsible. The subject matter expert's responsible for every step of that process. My role as custodian is to get my arms around them and say, we've got to protect the brand at every step of the people experience. So if we're going to talk about it up here, you've got to walk the talk down here.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's how you get people to buy into it. Because they go, oh, okay, I thought branding was just pretty pictures on the website. No. It is not. And I think that's a huge sea change of perception that this industry needs, because I think a lot of people are still in a place where they think that's what it is.
Yeah,
absolutely. They don't get what a brand is.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's where I love how you link so often employer brand and people experience, because they do go hand in hand, don't they?
Okay, so I summarize like this. Brand, quick high-level thing, branding. What is branding? Branding is about emotion. It is the mental associations that people have of you when they see you out in the wild or when they've had an experience with you. And let's water that down even more, right? If EVP is the logical things, mm-hmm. the pay, the perks, the people I work with, the projects I work on, if that's the logical decisions I make as to whether or not I want to work for you, and the example I use is I say this all the time, he's probably fed up of me saying it, Marcus Boddy's housing analogy. You go and buy a house, right? I want this many rooms, this many, the schools nearby, transport links, logical decisions.
Yeah.
I walk into five houses, they all tick those logical decisions, those logical things on my checklist. I still don't want the property. Why not? Don't know. Yeah. I walk into the final property, like, oh my God, this is the one. Don't know why. Can't think, it's just, the heart knows what the heart wants. It's a gut decision. Same with jobs. If you are a candidate and you've got three offers on the table, same, similar companies, similar sizes, similar industries, similar locations, similar package, there might be one that stands out. You can't quite put your finger on it, but it's a heart feeling. It comes from the gut. I'm going to go with company C.
Yeah.
That is what the brand does. Now, if it's based on emotion, especially when it comes to careers, people are fickle. And as I said before, I may love you today, I'll probably hate you tomorrow. And that hate will come. If you give me a bad experience, you're going to piss me off.
Mm.
And because this is just a transactional relationship, there's no emotional element to it, but it's about careers and jobs, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if I see a lovely bit of social media, oh, I love you. If I come to the career site, it's a great career site, oh, I love you even more.
Mm.
I then hit apply. That's the branding, right?
Yeah.
I then hit apply and I hit the underbelly of an ATS. And I've got to answer 79 questions, which are all multiple choice, and each multiple choice has 79 options. Oh, I don't think I love you anymore.
Yeah.
You started to damage the brand.
Absolutely.
So brand for me is about maintaining that emotional positive priming from beginning to end.
Yeah.
When someone leaves the company, how do you treat them? Because they're going to go and tell their friends and their family, and they're either going to advocate for you. Yeah, I worked there. Like I said about Pizza Hut. I haven't worked there for 15, 17, maybe, God, I'm getting old, a long time.
Yeah.
Well, I still think of Pizza Hut as one of the best cultures I've ever worked in for recognition. And if anyone said, should I work for Pizza Hut? I say, oh, I can't speak for it now, but when I was there, absolutely.
Yeah.
Such a good way. Yeah. That's brand.
Yeah. Beautifully articulated as well.
Reputation.
Yeah, absolutely. So look, just before we kind of round things off, I wondered, is it more of a quick fire thing more than anything, Ben, but you know, you and I both know there are so many employer branders out there quite often looking after a function that is far too big, you know, probably for one, even two, three people, you know, which is still a very small team as we know, but they're looking after these, you know, big operations from an employer brand perspective. So individual solo EBers or part of a very small team, that one person or those two or three people or whatever, constantly wearing multiple hats, spinning loads of different plates, you know, it could look quite chaotic from an outsider looking in. You know,
it is chaotic. It doesn't look chaotic, it is chaotic.
But anybody that's kind of listening that finds themselves in that kind of solo role or part of a very small team wearing multiple hats, what the key snippets of advice that you give to those types of people?
Number one, prioritize, which begs the question, how do I prioritize? Now, this is a difficult one, right? Because companies talk a great game about, yeah, we're customer centric and we're candidate centric. And in the next breath, they say, right, but this is what we want. And you go, oh, you've missed the point. Never mind. But anyway, number one, prioritize. Number two, if you can, and you're in an environment that is conducive for this, you prioritize by the candidate's needs. And we've all been candidates. And if it's just an instinctive, put yourself in the candidate's shoes, what is most important to them, like we talked about today, you could have 101 problems, but your application process is broken, fundamentally broken. Now people go, but the application, that's not branding. It is branding because it's the experience. It's not just content.
Mm.
Anything that impacts your brand is employer branding. And as we've talked about, that's heavy to do with emotion. What impacts emotion? The experience I have with you.
Mm-hmm.
So prioritize based on the candidate, what's most important to the candidate. And then it's baby steps. Don't go for big, what do they call them? Bags. They used to call them big hairy ass goals. I think someone used to call them BHAG, the acronym. Yeah. You can have those, great. But this is another psychological principle, right? The progress principle. As humans, we like to feel like we're making progress.
Mm-hmm.
And this is partly linked to marginal gains. You've got to celebrate the small wins, the baby steps, not just the big, grandiose, finalized, you know, completion of a project.
Mm-hmm.
So hone in on something, have focus. Otherwise, you spread yourself too thinly.
Mm-hmm.
Prioritize based on the candidate's needs. Start small. This is design thinking and coming from tech. MVP. What's the minimal viable product going to be?
Yeah.
And then linked to prioritization, another way to prioritize, you may have heard of the time to implement versus business impact quadrant. Mm. Don't know if you've seen that.
No.
On the x-axis, you've got time to implement. On the y-axis, you've got impact to the business.
Mm-hmm.
And on the x-axis, the horizontal axis, at the point it joins the y-axis, it starts with lots of time and it goes out to no time, like long time to short time.
Yeah.
And the vertical axis, the y-axis, is the impact, no impact to high impact, going mm-hmm. upwards. Something that takes short amount of time but has the biggest impact goes in the upper right quadrant.
Okay. Yeah.
There's one of your priorities.
Fine, gotcha. Yeah.
So you look at your candidate experience. What do candidates care about most? They care about the application process. Okay, can we go into the ATS and just update this ridiculously long application form? What is the information we genuinely need, both legally from a compliance perspective? Do we need these 90? Do we need to know their entire leg measurements? Do we need them to submit a DNA swab? I'm being facetious, but you know what I mean.
Exactly. Or can we get that later on in the process at some point?
Really? Later on, do we even need it? What's the value exchange
right now? Yeah.
Do we need it? And how long would that take us? Oh, we could probably fix that in 2 days. Well, how much would that impact the candidate experience? Massively. Stick it in the upper right quadrant box of that quadrant I just mentioned.
So that quadrant basically looks after your weighting, doesn't it? Of how you prioritize your time and what you get fixed first.
Yeah. If it's going to take loads of time and have no impact on the business, the bottom left part of that quadrant, don't do it.
Yeah, that can just get rid of it. Manana. Yeah.
If it's going to take you too long and have no impact to the business, why are you doing it?
Yeah. Love it. That's really, really
good.
Or
if it's going to take you a lot of time but has a massive impact on the business, that doesn't become a tactical execution. That becomes a strategic initiative.
Mm.
So you plan for that longer and that requires program or project management. But there will be things. The emails that come out of the ATS, are they dry or do they have personality in them? And how long would it take? Well, I could probably sit down in a week if we've got 17, 15 bits of comms that goes out the ATS. Let me go in and update them. That's one person for 1 week dedicating a couple of hours a day. That's quick to implement. And from a candidate experience, feel like they're being nurtured. That gets rid of idleness aversion. That gets rid of operational anxiety. That gets rid of all the other stuff we talked about. That goes in the upper right quadrant. It doesn't take time, but has a massive impact on the candidate experience. Prioritize that.
Really like it. So, Ben, we always round off the podcast in the same way with the same question.
I thought about this one.
Yeah, I thought you might know this one. But, question's always the same. But if you could give people out there advice on how to avoid being employer bland, what is the advice that you'd give them?
We've got to be more real in this industry. People want to get cut through. They want to be distinctive. I think that happens in the communication of the EVPs we spoke about previously, which, like I said, 10, 12 years ago, Tesco were talking about the same thing that most people are talking about today, right? So what does be real mean? And people that see my content, they've seen in the background, it's called Reveal the Real, more on that at a later date. But that's the premise of employer branders, I think, for too long have believed our role is to sell. sell the company.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we've inherited that from consumer marketing. I don't think our role is to sell, because when your mind is in a sell, and I've been in recruitment for 8 years, remember, so I'm very aware of different types of selling, sophisticated consultative selling and sleazy secondhand car market trader sales. but when your mind is in sales mode, it implies by hook or by crook, convince them no matter what to join our business.
Mm-hmm.
So that comes out of consumer marketing, whereby the goal is to convince 99% of the market that your product is what they need and want. In employer branding, it's the reverse of that. We want 1% of the population to buy in to what we're about so they can stay, strive, thrive, all that kind of good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So when you reveal, and I've been banging about this for a couple of years now, again, some people ad nauseum will probably say, if you think about revealing the realities of what it's like to work in your business, that changes your tone.
Mm-hmm.
Because it says, this is what we are, this is what we're about, this is how we work, we're innovative, but that means we've got no resources, so you've got to be scrappy. If you come from an abundance of resources, you're going to struggle here, you're going to hate it.
Mm-hmm.
We're collaborative, but actually it means it's decision by committee. So in that last company, you woke up with an idea in the morning, you implemented it in the afternoon. That's not going to happen here. It's going to frustrate the hell out of you. We're high-performing. That's the new one, isn't it? High-performing, what a high-performing culture. You know what high-performing means? It means most of the people in this business were captains of their school sports teams. They are competitive. Sometimes they're a bit aggressive.
Mm.
You've got to have thick skin. They tell it how it is. They ain't got time. You're running at 100 miles an hour all the time.
Mm.
If you're used to loafing about, taking your time, easy breezy, you're going to hate it here.
Mm.
So it's not about being negative. It's about revealing reality and having an adult conversation. So if you want to avoid being employer bland, please, people, please, we've got to get better at doing that, because everything else at the moment is glossy, high five, overly polished content, which effectively is PR, which people don't buy anymore.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's such brilliant advice. And it's not about, you know, the good, the bad, and the ugly. It is about real, isn't it? It's
about the good of reality.
Because good, bad, ugly will come through, but don't think of it like that. Just radiate you who you are. And I tell you what, you know, I kind of liken it to there are some relatively obscure, like, comedians that I follow on Instagram, for example, and they've got these followings of, like, they're not huge, but 8,000, 10,000, 15,000. And they seem to have, like, stabilized at that kind of level. But I find them extremely funny. It's 10 times funnier than a lot of these people that have got 500,000 followers and stuff. Those guys are doing brilliantly well as well. But I love the way those types of people, and this is a siloed example, you know, akin to what you're talking about, but they are being extremely authentic in their style and who they are, what they're about. They're not following a blueprint of comedy to get the masses involved. They're not following all the trends that, you know, the algorithm hacks that get you to 500,000. They're just, I find them extremely funny. Those other 8,000-10,000 people also find them extremely funny, you know, clearly. But do you kind of liken it to that in a way where it's just like, put yourself out there, but just don't worry about the fluff and the bullshit?
Absolutely.
It will
100%. You know what? The best brands fall into one of two buckets, love and hate.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, there are so many brands that swim in the middle, the river of meh.
Yeah.
And
river of meh.
And you can't relate to it. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm a human being, and I used to give a shit about what people thought about me. If I'm being honest, I still do. I put my content out and think, oh my God, someone's going to think I'm a complete numpty. Oh my God, they're going to think I'm an idiot. Those thoughts still happen. Then I go, no, hold up the mirror, be your real self.
Yeah.
I don't want everyone to love me.
Mm.
You know, if half a dozen people think it's great, brilliant, that's all I need. Mm. I don't need the whole masses, because I'm not going to appeal to everyone. And when you try and appeal to everyone, which most of these brands in employer branding try to do, even though they don't need to, we want our EVP to be distinctive, but we want to appeal to everyone. What? Doesn't even make sense. You want to be distinctive because you want to appeal to a distinct audience.
Yeah.
Anyway, so much to unpack there, but yeah. you exactly what you've said. I don't care about followers. I remember, and this, again, it's the same conversation that's been going on for the last 20 years since Facebook and social blew up. I sat down with my boss when I joined into Tesco, and he said, how quickly do you think you can get us 5,000 followers on Twitter? And I said, I could buy them tomorrow. do you want 5,000 followers on Twitter, or do you rather have 500 followers who could potentially be candidates relevant to working in this organization? Mm-hmm. Now, at the time, he went, I'll have the 5,000 followers, please. You slammed your face into the wall with a pencil up your nose. But, you know.
At least he was honest.
but it's to say, but it's that education piece. I don't care. I don't. It's like if you're a small business, right? Do you want 10,000 followers or do you want 500 customers, repeat business,
yeah,
who actually care about what you say? It's about that. Same as employer branding. Yeah. You want to appeal to the people who can come into your environment, who want to start, who want to stay, they want to strive, they want to thrive, they want to succeed. That won't be everybody. When people are comfortable with that, it hones you in on creating content and telling stories that would appeal to the people that will be able to achieve all those things.
Absolutely. And a brilliant way for us to round things off, I think. So, Ben, always brilliant talking to you. Thank you so much joining me. And I've really enjoyed it.
Thanks, man. Likewise. Thanks for having me.
No worries. Speak soon.
Cheers, buddy. Bye.
Cheers. Bye.